60 target. The 2030 target is good. The 2061 needs to be brought back in terms of going completely carbon neutral. The reality is, whether we like it or not, when China decides to do something at the top, they can deliver and make it happen because of a different political reality. I think that it's time that China does recognize, as the United States needs to, that it is in their self-interest to make these changes as fast as possible. And let me just say, in fairness to China, that historically...
We have 15 seconds to end.
Oh, okay. So I think now is the time for action. We must evaluate the summit not in terms of vague promises. We need to see what the implementation plan, and they need to be checked in Glasgow to make sure that this was just not another talk shop. Thank you.
Kumi Naidoo, I want to thank you for being with us, Special Advisor for the Green Economy Coalition's Social Contract Initiative, former head of Amnesty International and Greenpeace, and Dipti Bhatnagar of Friends of the Earth International. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Do you miss going to the theater? Looking for some drama? Then tune in for The Strange Case of Nick M., an all-new radio play by Imago Theater on Monday, May 3rd at 10 p.m. Listeners will be taken on Imago's trippy audio journey into a fragmentary world, narrated by a cocky podcaster who has unearthed a box of long-forgotten reel-to-reel tapes. So tune in on Monday, May 3rd at 10 p.m. and get ready for a very special premiere of Imago's The Strange Case of Nick M. right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. It's Friday. Coming up is The Gap. In the meantime, KBOO Community Radio would like to thank Kristen, Rebecca, and three anonymous members who have helped to support KBOO's spring membership drive today. Join these generous supporters and help us reach our $60,000 fundraising goal by going to kboo.fm/give, or you can text KBOO to the number 44321. Now stay tuned for The Gap, because we're going to bridge it. Stand by.
Good morning, everyone. How's it going? This is The Gap here on KBOO Portland. I'm Tammy. On the line with me is the one and only Althea. Hello, Althea.
Hello. Good morning. We're here.
We are here, bridging the gap between Zoomers, Boomers, and everything in between. Just a couple of millennials asking what the alpha is going on. Oh, man. We're still asking that question. For every answer we're getting, we get more questions. So
yeah,
that's where we're at. And of course, Sonia, thank you so much for keeping us on the air. And thank you to all the awesome people that are donating to our current drive.
You're welcome.
Fantastic, yeah. And like we mentioned, we are in our spring membership drive, and our theme is Growing the Grassroots. And that is what we do here on The Gap, and just here on KBOO in general. If you want to support the station, our programming and other programming like this, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. I thought something was going to start once I hit one, but it didn't. Just the love and embrace of the listeners. It's another Friday, and it's great to be here. Great to be heard. And we are going to be doing things a little different. We are going to be opening up the phone lines in about 15 to 20 minutes, and we're going to still have like a part A and part B that we'll just want to hear listeners' opinions and comments on more than just one subject. So there's something to be mindful about. And just in case, get that phone number ready for you. It's 503-231-8187. Oh, man, so we'll just dive right into it. Wednesday was a big day. Althea, would you agree? Would you say that was a big day for you? For you, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I think the verdict in the Chauvin murder trial came out Tuesday, but then Wednesday is, like, kind of digesting all of it. And I was, like, you know, waiting by the phone, ready to hear it. And I got my time zones mixed up. I was, because they said that it would be out at like 4:30 or 5. And I was like, okay, 4:30 or 5. Like, I'm ready. I'm there. And I was like on the phone doing a different interview. And then I opened my phone and 15 minutes ago, the verdict drops. And I was like, dang it, Central Time. I forgot about you. But we did get a verdict in the murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Jury did not deliberate wrong. And they decided that he's guilty on all three counts that he was charged with in the murder of George Floyd.
And so today we are going to talk about the actual charges and do a very small breakdown of what they mean, I guess, in reference to the murder itself. So the first one was second degree unintentional murder. The charge was for Chauvin causing Floyd's death without intent while committing or attempting to commit felony third degree assault. In turn, third degree assault is defined as the unintentional infliction of substantial bodily harm.
Intentional. You said unintentional. I just wanted to. Intentional.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Intentional. Yeah, sorry. Excuse me. And these definitions are coming from CNN.com from their legal correspondent. The third degree murder charge alleged Chauvin's caused Floyd's death by perpetrating an act eminently dangerous to others and inventing a depraved mind without regard for human life. That is an intense charge, but I would thought that would be the one that the jury would not be able to deliver on, and I'm shocked that they delivered on all three counts as quickly as they did. That was also like a big thing for me.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, I think that it indicates that there wasn't too much disagreement within the jury.
Mm-hmm. And we can I'd love to hit that after we finish this last charge because there was a lot to say about the actual footage of what the judge was talking about the verdict. I don't know, in my mind it could be completely wrong. It seemed like maybe there's a little bit of pep in his step and a little smile on his face, but we'll hear in the audio that the judge also was pretty surprised at how quickly this turned around. But yes, the last one is the second-degree manslaughter charge, which alleged Chauvin's caused Floyd's death by culpable negligence, whereby the person creates an unreasonable risk and consciously takes chances of causing death or greater bodily harm. And we do have that clip of the judge actually reading out the verdicts and him speaking at the jury, and I don't know if you could hit that up real quick.
Members of the jury, I will now read the verdicts as they will appear in the permanent records of the 4th Judicial District. State of Minnesota, County of Hennepin, District Court, 4th Judicial District. State of Minnesota Plaintiff versus Derek Michael Chauvin, Defendant. Verdict, Count 1. Court file number 27, CR20-12646. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to Count 1, unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April, 2021 at 1:44 p.m. Signed, juror foreperson, juror number 19. Same caption, verdict count 2. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count 2, third-degree murder, perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April, 2021 at 1:45 p.m. Signed by jury foreperson, juror number 19. Same caption, verdict count 3. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count 3, second-degree manslaughter, culpable negligence, creating an unreasonable risk, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April, 2021 at 1:45 p.m. Jury foreperson 019. I have to thank you on behalf of the people of the state of Minnesota for not only jury service, but heavy-duty jury service.
Thank you, Judge. And I just want to be super clear that I did edit that down from like a 4-minute clip to about a minute there. There is a part in the judgment where the judge has to ask each juror by number that they agree to it, and they did one by one agree to it, but it would take too long, and I've got to save that airtime. So now currently Chauvin is in jail, max security in solitary confinement. So one talking point that a lot of people had brought up, even just as soon as this came out, is that if he is to be put in general population, it would be a different story than him being locked away for 23 hours with the 1 hour of being out. That did happen. We are still not sure. We still don't have actual sentencing. We still have a little ways to go, but the verdict is in, and we just heard it.
We can talk about what the sentencing might look like, because it's been tossed around that he would face like max 40 years in prison, and it depends for each charge, right? Like there's a mandatory minimums. Oh my God, the sarcasm. Please read sarcasm in that, and also that I couldn't spit it out, but that it kind of depends on an individual state sentencing guidelines and how much of a risk Chauvin is considered to be. So there's up to 40 years in prison for second degree murder, up to 25 for third degree, and 10 years for second degree manslaughter. But that can kind of be changed depending on if you have prior convictions and what your life outside of these convictions has looked like. The sentencing guidelines in Minnesota say 12 and a half years in prison for each murder charge and 4 for the manslaughter charge. So that doesn't quite rack up as high as if he was sentenced to be to the maximum amount. And the judge also gets to decide if they are served concurrently or successively. So that could mean that it's 12 and a half years total if they're served all at the same time for all 3 charges, which is an interesting wrinkle.
Yeah, it'd be very different than what we're looking at right now, a significant change. And right after the verdict was announced, the DOJ announced that they are going to be opening up an investigation, and they're going to be examining whether the police department are using excessive force to treat minorities unfairly. I'm no examiner of the DOJ, but I'm just going to throw that out there and say I think so, yes. But also, it will, the and I'm quoting from the New York Times, the inquiry will also scrutinize police training and accountability practices, amongst other issues. Now, I have another clip from NBC, and we have former federal prosecutor Cynthia A. I forgot her last name, and she will be speaking on the other officers or former officers that were involved in the murder, because we'll say their time in court will also be coming up soon. So, Sonia, if you got that audio, please go ahead and hit it.
Let's turn now to NBC News legal analyst Cynthia Oxney. So, Cynthia, you're a former federal prosecutor. What's your reaction? Was this the verdict you expected?
It is the verdict I expected. I'm not just a former federal prosecutor, but I prosecuted police cases. So it's something that is near and dear to me, and I recognize how incredibly difficult they are. You know, it's worth reflecting today to let people realize how difficult these cases are, that when George Floyd originally died, the statement from the police department just was, man dies after medical incident. Officers were able to handcuff him. He was in medical distress. They called an ambulance, and he died. And that was the press release. I tweeted it out. But for that video and the bravery of the people around, we would never really have had this case. George Floyd would have died, and we never would have had any a winnable trial but for the video. And then finally we see that police officers supported the prosecution all the way up from the first officer on the scene all the way to the police chief. But of course they knew and were able to testify that it was excessive force because of the video. So everything hinged on that video and the bravery of that young lady to take it.
That's absolutely true. Something that is so worth talking about, especially given that she was just 17 years old at the time that she took that video, and it's what's caused this whole movement. Now, Cynthia, so now we have this count, these two counts of murder and this count of manslaughter where Derek Chauvin has been found guilty. Now, there are three former officers that are also expected to face trial for aiding and abetting second-degree murder and manslaughter charges in August. Now that we have this guilty verdict on those three charges here for Chauvin, what kind of effect does that have on this case we see later this summer?
Wow, it has a huge effect on the case. Those defendants are going to have to make a couple of decisions. First off, I'm sure there will be plea offers, particularly to the two rookies. There were two officers who, this was their third or fourth shift, and they, the officer said, oh, I'm worried he doesn't have a pulse, and the other officer. Those two, my guess is, they'll be pretty reasonable plea offers. And then Officer Tao, who stood there and kept the crowd back and kept that EMT officer from providing any assistance to George Floyd, is also he's the one who's in the most amount of trouble in terms of not getting a plea offer that he's really looking for. So they're going to have to make a decision about plea officers. The other thing they have to make a decision about is whether or not they're going to have a jury trial or a judge trial. And my guess is all those negotiations are going on. I wouldn't be surprised if this ended all in plea arrangements for all three officers.
And Cynthia, for Chauvin, sentencing is now 8 weeks away. How much prison time could he be facing, and what is the judge going to consider when making the decision?
All right, well, Minnesota has sentencing guidelines, like most states, and the sentencing guidelines for each of these top two counts are like 10 and three quarters to 15, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean the judge has to give that sentence. He'll get a pre-sentence report, which they're going to work on now, and he'll also evaluate whether or not they're aggravating of circumstances. The prosecutors in this case have said they are going to file a motion that the sentencing should be higher than the recommended 10 and three quarters to 15 because of aggravating circumstances. One of those is that Chauvin was in a position of trust and authority. Another one may be his refusal to provide any aid. And so we'll see if they come up with others. There's no rule on how many aggravating circumstances they apply for. So once the prosecution says we want this higher sentence, the defense will have an opportunity to respond, and the judge would ultimately rule. I would guess he goes a little higher, but you don't really know. So certainly it's in somewhere in the 12 to 20 range for each count,
Cynthia,
in the top two counts.
Cynthia, so much of that is so complicated. So thank you for breaking it down for us as we all look to what happens next. No, you did a great job. Thank you so much.
Cynthia Oxney, thank you. Thank you so much. That was a clip from NBC, a former federal prosecutor talking about the former officers that were around Chauvin and George Floyd as Chauvin was murdering him in broad daylight in front of people. So that is that clip. And just want to remind you, we are going to be taking calls in just a minute or two. The phone number is 503-231-8187. And we are going to be asking the community question of where do we go from here? That's a question that we'd like for you to call in for. As far as the movement for racial justice, for police accountability, the country, local communities, where do we go from here? Again, that number is 503-231-8187.
Sophia? Yeah, I think it's good to highlight, you know, that there were these other officers involved that also have their own consequences that they're facing, because I think on Tuesday there was, my hope is that it doesn't, the push behind the Chauvin trial, the push behind George Floyd's murder to change the systems that allowed for it to happen, this can't be the end of that, you know? The Chauvin verdict doesn't actually fix the problem at hand, and in fact the problem is a lot bigger than just one cop.
Yeah, and that same day we also got the video was released of a 13-year-old boy, Adam Toledo, being shot. So we're seeing that it's like half a step forward, 10 steps back. This is going to have ripple effects, I hope. And again, we'd love to hear you, the listener, what is your opinion of where do we go from here? 503-231-8187. That is really interesting. They had a lot of they had a protest there in Minneapolis outside the courthouse, and the reactions were so like you were saying, where, you know, people were really excited that there was something, but we are aware, cautiously optimistic, or aware that this isn't the end, you know, this isn't the end game.
Yeah, and there's also been like a stat that's been highlighted that I think is definitely worth talking about, which is that like since 2005, it's either 5 or 8 police officers have ever been convicted of murder, and like 15,000 people have been killed by cops in that time. So it really is a unique and rare occurrence that police who kill people of any race, let alone Black folks who are routinely targeted by police, that they ever get accountability for the officers that perpetrated that.
Yeah, this is a couple. While I was looking for some audio for today, I found this really interesting audio or video of people, police officers, talking about the verdict, and the question that was posed to them was, is this verdict, do you feel like the cops are on trial, or do you think this is a specific trial? Like, what are your views on it? And the, you know, because everyone has their biases, so whatever channel that had that video, they had their biases. But it was really interesting for because, you know, another cop to talk about it in a way that they themselves, like that who happened to be a Black cop too, saying that he feels a bit more comfortable knowing that there is going to be some sort of accountability. But like you said, that is one, or like how many were, you said 13 out of how many? And this verdict itself is not, I did not think it would go this way. I was shocked. And it is a shocking verdict because it doesn't happen every day while we are seeing, almost every day we're seeing a new video of police brutality. So it's going somewhere. But also, I think on local front, there has been some effect. You know, we are going through like a new direction. Last week we did mention what is happening on the police front as far as the another DOJ investigation, but also the rest of the commissioners pushing back on Ted Wheeler wanting to add more to the budget or to deputize more officers. So there is, while it seems like Ted Wheeler is pushing for more, we have a couple of commissioners that are pushing against it. And I don't know if they would have done that if it wasn't for how people showed up during the summertime, and if it wasn't for this trial, and if it wasn't for all of this. So is that a ripple effect as far as local community? I think so. I think that this is it's a sign of that.
Mm-hmm.
I do.
And, you know, thinking about this, like the scope of the impact that has come of all of this, that people have become much more comfortable with, I don't know, questioning the status quo, which we didn't necessarily see in the Chauvin's trial, right? Like, prosecution was pretty careful to, like, emphasize that they're not putting, you know, police in general on trial. They're putting, you know, one bad apple on trial, which I think was successful in this moment because some of what we knew leading into the trial and part of jury selection was that there were people who were like, well, this, I definitely feel like this is bad, but I don't know that I feel that cops in general have a systemic problem. And so I think that's part of why they were able to get the verdict that they did. But I think looking at the Portland community and the conversations that the summertime protests sparked, you know, that there was an 81% margin passing the new police oversight structure, that's really significant, a major shift in terms of like questioning, you know, systems and restructuring things so that they work for the people. I mean, we haven't seen that come to fruition. And we talked about last week that there's, you know, we have our own DOJ inquiry into police brutality here that can throw a wrench in those things, but that there are new movements that are happening out of it. Sonia, you want to chime in here?
Oh, sure. The whole thing about juries, the purpose of the jury is putting the people between the state and those it wishes to deprive of liberty, property, and even life. And so jury trials are always an expression of the public will. So anything that shifts public opinion, anything that or that shows a shift of public opinion lets everyone else know that, you know, this is where we are, and people who feel similarly can know that the rest of society is moving in their same direction, that they are not the only one who thinks or feels this way. And that, so any public manifestation of this kind, you mentioned the months, the 100+ days of continuous demonstrations, that police abuse is indeed systemic, and you can put one, you can make a decision on whether to hold one individual officer accountable for how they act out a system-wide, a systemic issue, right? To hold them accountable for like their actions as a symptom, and then you know that those 12 people in that jury box saw last summer. And they know that there's a real tide of opinion on this, and that it's moving in this direction. And that empowers and emboldens people who understand the need to hold individual police accountable for their carrying out these systemic, demands, requirements, to harass and brutalize certain people. So that's where protest comes in to all this.
Right, that's interesting. I would love to hear callers, we'd love to hear listeners' calls and opinions, 503-231-8187, about this subject, where are we going from here? And Senator just brought up a really, really interesting point of, it being a jury trial, and that it was the people's will that was ignited by during the summer, and it showed. It showed, and they saw that he was guilty, and they held him accountable. And again, I wasn't expecting that. I knew something would come out. I wasn't expecting America to be ready to really look at itself and hear these charges and agree. I thought it was unbelievable. And our question to you is, where do we go from here as far as the movement, police accountability for the country, our local governments, just or local communities? Again, the number is 503-231-8187. Althea, I have where do you think our local grassroots organizing, what role do you think it played in all this? Because I'm thinking all of it. If it wasn't for the grassroots, if it wasn't for that one person taking that photo or taking that video, all it took is one person to take that video to have this shared with us. Because like the video was saying, when the murder was reported as a person who had just died, it didn't report that he was executed in daylight by a police officer. And if it wasn't for that one person's video that a lot of people saw and shared and was presented in court, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
people power.
Totally the power of the people, and totally getting more folks acquainted with having that eye of scrutiny towards the police and what the police narrative is. Honestly, I was not aware that was what their press statement on it was last year, and so hearing that was shocking. And it aligned yesterday with this thing that happened to comedian Eric Andre, who was harassed at the Atlanta airport by the local sheriff's department, like racially profiled. And then seeing their write-up of it just absolutely contrary. It's like, no, he wanted to talk to us and offered that we could look in his bag, but we said we didn't want to. And, having a new understanding of the way that, the police and their presence, their outward-facing presence is incredibly calculated, is, spun in such a way that police are almost always blameless, and that's part of what the Department of Justice is investigating in Portland. Right, we had this settlement in 2014, and they sat in on some of the accountability sessions more recently that have barely scratched the surface of police abuse of protesters over the summer, and the DOJ saw that we're out of compliance because those people on that committee were accepting whatever the individual cop's justification was as enough, that, oh, the situation was dangerous enough that I could, pepper spray a woman in the face or shoot random bystanders because they looked like they were having a conversation. That was not, raised to a level of concern, raised to a level of accountability is incredibly, I can't even find the word for it, but we got a caller on the line. Jenny? What are your thoughts?
Hi. Thank you so much. I wanted to comment about the local issues, because while I think that there is some reason for hope, definitely, there's just a lot of vigilance and a lot of work to be done. And I'd like to point to the Lentz Park killing, police killing, just very recently in Portland.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up.
So, yeah, if you look at the media reports, there's not one story that's consistent with the other. There's a video out there that shows after the guy was shot, the sniper, who's a famous sniper, by the way, on TV for his great exploits in Afghanistan. Anyway, he, after they shot him and he's motionless, he keeps yelling for literally 10 or 15 minutes, "Put your hands up or we'll shoot you again." This goes on for a long time and the guy is laying there dead. It's the most appalling thing I've seen here in Portland since Coben Henriksen, Andre Gladden, Lane Martin, Quinice Hayes. I mean, there's too much work to do in this town. This is ground zero for police white supremacy. The Portland police had the first police union in the country in the 20s, 1920s, so 100 years ago, and you had to be in the KKK to join the police force. I'm too kind of upset to continue, but I really think this needs some type of investigation that has never been done in this city. Let him lay there dead for several minutes, many minutes, telling him to get up, you know, or they'll shoot it. I mean, it didn't even make any sense. They're hiding behind it. Anyway, please do the research. Thank you so much for the show. It's really awesome.
Thank you, Johnny. Thank you so much. And yeah, that's Robert Delgado, who was you're talking about, who was shot and killed in Lentz Park. Yeah, I feel you. I hear your distress in your voice, and yeah, it is distressing, and there's a lot of work to do. We also have Franny on the line. Franny, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
All as well as well as it can be. I would love to hear your opinion. Thank you for calling in.
Okay, great. And I'll just be brief because I actually have to jump on a work Zoom soon. But I think it occurred to me at some point that, you know, when the police get a call, and I might be wrong about this, but I think when they get a call like a night, somebody calls 911 and says, "Oh, there's a crime taking place," whatever, that the 911 officer asks about the race of the person. Pretty sure about that. So that means that when white police officers or any police officers are, you know, responding to a call and they know the race of the person, like, don't you think in this day and age, if they weren't racist and they weren't intentionally wanting to hurt black people, which I think is what's going on, then they would be like, "Oh, you know, given everything that's gone on here with police brutality against black people and police killing of black people, maybe I should calm down before I get to this call involving a black person." But instead, they just roll up like all fired up and like angry and all of it, you know? So to me, that absence of taking a pause is just more proof in my heart that this is all intentional. And I think Derek Chauvin set out to intentionally kill George Floyd. And so that's my comment. Thank you for having the show.
Thank you, Franny. Thank you so much. That's something that we are seeing, some of us see, while others are willing to make excuses for it. What we need to know exactly what they look like. Yeah, I get that. I do get that. But it's a lot of factors. It's the type of questions for the descriptions. And then another layer is the person calling to begin with. If someone is calling because there's someone hanging out in their car and they happen to not be a white person? Is that, like, that's what's scared, like, that's what's suspicious about it? Like, really taking a pause, taking a second to understand, are you just being a racist, or do you actually feel like there is a situation here? Because being black is not a crime. I want to repeat it. Being black is not a crime. It's not a crime. Being black is okay. You can't help it. It is what it is. And as soon as other folks realize it exists while being black, who knows? But that's my thing for the day, my PSA.
Thank you, Franny. Yeah, I wanted to mention one thing about the Lentz Park killing, because there's some interesting aspects of the 911 dispatch. I think it's a Willamette Week article that discusses and kind of turns an eye toward how the 911 dispatch, like what they ask of the person calling, like really does have an influence on how cops respond. I'll put a link to it on our episode page if you're looking for that link. But part of it being out in Lentz, I believe it was 9:30 a.m. and the Portland Street Response Team, which is sort of meant to be, you know, an intermediary with an EMT, a social worker, and someone with experience with dealing with people with, you know, in mental crises, are doing the pilot program in Lentz, let me just say that. But they're not on the clock until 10 a.m. So they weren't called in this situation. And another thing that the article highlighted was that, you know, Robert Delgado, the caller said that, you know, they were like drawing a gun around that, like they were a cowboy or something. But at no point did the dispatcher ask about, oh, does it have an orange tip, which is like one of the key like things to notice about a fake gun, which in this case it was. So it's a very interesting article, and interesting to think about all the different aspects that go into, you know, police responding on the scene. It's both the person calling, the person reporting the incident. It's the 911 dispatch deciding which cops get put there, and are they, you know, are they de-escalation cops, are they the ones that are trained in this kind of thing, or in this case they sent beat cops, you know, general assignment, as I think Jenny noted, one of them had been a sniper in Afghanistan, and that bringing that kind of energy without the training of, you know, de-escalation or anything like that to this situation, broad daylight, Lentz Park, it was a choice. And it ended really badly.
It hurt, you know, I just think that people, these questions are so important. And, you know, like we had mentioned the DOJ investigation here in Portland, you know, that how they sat in on the meetings and they saw that there was excessive force, but it's beyond that. It's the fact that their own standard, they weren't maintaining their own standard of what is considered excessive force, what is considered, overuse, abuse of power. Your own standard that you're creating, you're not upholding. Why? And I don't know. It's like in the Lentz Park shooting. Is there like zero awareness of what's happening in the world and in this country right now? Like, it's crazy. I don't understand it. It only makes me think that it's done on purpose, you know, and it really worries me. And as a black woman, if I need to protect myself in one way or another, a situation happens, I don't know who I'm calling. I really don't know. It's a scary situation. And it's like, God, it's just so layered. Sonia, I'd love to hear from you right now. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, we've got, when you said, as Jenny mentioned, and I think Franny as well, and as you just did, like, it's hard to not see this as on purpose. And I'll take that a step further. It's like an assertion of power. It's like, we the people asserted our power convicting a murderous cop, a homicidal cop, a homicidal, someone we have empowered to exercise discretion over our ability to move freely in the world, who then used that power to brutalize people and to kill. And that person was held accountable for that. And now the police are turning around saying, oh, yeah? And then there's the, what's that little suburb just 10 miles outside of Minneapolis? Bellevue something, Bellevue Park, Bellevue Center?
Brooklyn Center.
Yeah. We're flying a blue line flag right outside their precinct that very day, Tuesday, April 20th, or Wednesday, April 21st. It's basically they've been waging a low-intensity, undeclared war on the people. The people made a blow in their own defense, saying, no, we will hold you to account. We will not just let you abuse us without consequence. And now the police are metaphorically and literally firing back.
Well, that's... Sonia, thank you for that perspective.
This is a message.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we're going to take a very short musical break, and we're going to come right back, and we're going to just keep this conversation going. I think I'm loving these points. I'm learning so much, and the listener conversations are really fantastic. We want to keep them going. So we're going to be keeping on taking our phone calls. Please call at 503-231-8187. We are discussing what's next after this verdict. What is next for the community? What's next for the movement, the country, local government, us, grassroots organizers, everything in between? Again, the number is 503-231-8187. We'll be back after this very short musical break.
None of some of that wonderful, wonderful, very familiar technical weirdness cutting off our musical break. Let's check with the other girls. Are y'all ready to just come back?
Yeah, we're here.
All right. Take it.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland here on your 90.7 FM dial. This is The Gap. Where we are bridging the gap between Zoomers, Boomers, and everything in between. I am Tammy, and the line with me is the fantastic, brilliant Althea Billings, and of course, Sonia. And we are taking community question or community comments about where we go from here post trial and verdict of Derek Chauvin, who has been found guilty of all three charges of murdering George Floyd last summer. Again, the phone number is 503-231-8187. We want to hear from you, the listener. Where do we go from here? The movement, police accountability, the country, and of course, us here locally, from the grassroots organizing to the just everyday person, just trying to, I don't know, just trying to live through this, because all of this is happening while we're still in the additional layer of the pandemic, and while it seemed like we were kind of, numbers are going back up, but people are getting vaccinated. There's just so much happening, but we really want to know and hear from you about what your opinion is of where we go from here, where you'd like to go from here, where you hope to go from here. One last time, 503-231-8187 is the phone number. Yes, Sophia.
Yeah, I wanted to, before the break, Sonia was highlighting, the reaction that police have had to a changing public opinion, a changing climate of how they view them. And I think there's a lot of ways that we can, think about that specifically, right? Even the phrase defund the police is, for some people, and how they viewed police prior to that becoming, a commonplace saying, would feel incredibly foreign to them, or the idea of demilitarizing the police, or the idea that, hey, maybe police aren't the best tool for all of the problems that a city might have. Maybe our tax dollars could be better spent, and isn't it worth trying? And then also things that we've seen recently as well, with visible animosity, and in fact stated animosity, between the Portland Police Bureau and the Multnomah County District Attorney, that there was video that surfaced, and I've mentioned this before on the show, video that surfaced of a uniformed Portland police officer going to a neighborhood association meeting in uniform as a representative of the police and campaigning against DA Mike Schmidt, saying that if you want crime to go down, if you want things to be safe, you need to get Schmidt out of there. Mind you, Mike Schmidt was voted in overwhelmingly in a primary, like took over office early because he ran on this platform of racial justice, and especially in regards to protests, would not be pressing charges on the sort of petty charges that police often slap on a protester to try to intimidate them, to try to keep them out of the streets, whether that's interfering with a police officer or like refusing an order to disperse. Those are not the types of things that Schmidt would be prosecuting, and so then you see this cop openly arguing against it. And then there was the whole Joanne Hardesty thing, like that there is a conspiracy within the cops or within the police union, take your pick, there's a sense of who their enemies are. There is a sense of those who wish to change the system, and that they are exerting some power over that. Sonia, you want to chime in here?
It's kind of an aside about, no, I lost it. Sorry, go on.
Okay. The Joanne Hardesty situation. I think that was the first thing I thought when we had a caller. I think Jenny mentioned Franny mentioned how the dispatch asked for the description and skin color or race. And the first thing I thought was like that situation of Joanne Hardesty being. It was beyond racially profiled. It was like pretty much targeted for a hit and run, which had nothing to do with her. And they were trying to pin this case on her that had nothing to do with her. And the only thing that may have been some sort of commonality is that perhaps maybe it was just like a racial profiling situation. But we have talked about this, and you can go check out KB KBOO.fm/thegap and check out our show notes from that day. And Sona, did I hear you say something over
yes.
there?
Yes. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
D.A. Schmidt's refusal to pursue these spurious charges that police bring against protesters as a tool of intimidation really just highlights the essential spuriousness of those charges. They are not meant to hold people accountable for breaking the law. They are meant to just clear the streets. There's no intention or desire for any of these charges on the part of the police on the scene to make any of these charges stick, because it's not about actually prosecuting cases against people who, it's just about creating legal hassle. It's about clearing the streets first, and then it's about secondarily about creating legal hassle for people. That's your tool of intimidation. They know that there's no way that these charges could actually stick. They know that the charges are entirely spurious. That's not the point. The point is to make things difficult and to punish you for being in the street, for opposing
Which
them.
Is a First Amendment right. That
Yes. To punish you for exercising your rights effectively.
Well, also in this case, trying to overwhelm the DA's office out of spite as well. That yes, exactly what Sonia said, trying to intimidate people out of the streets, but also swamping the DA so that, you know, more serious things can't necessarily be addressed. And this is nothing, even not to speak of earlier this year, where there were claims of the Portland police not showing up to call like domestic violence incidents, or, you know, more routine type situations where cops were called, they don't show up, or they show up 3 hours later as a method of trying to convince people that the slash to their budget was that detrimental to them.
I remember they did this during about 10 years ago during the occupation of Lonsdale Square and Chapman and all that area. In 2011, there were reports of assaults and everything, and police just didn't come and explicitly said, hey, we don't have time to deal with that because there's all these people hanging out in Lonsdale Square. And it's like, as if that's more important to them. Really, they're telling on themselves, saying a challenge to the system is a higher priority than actual danger to people.
Yeah, it's a good time to, you know, remind, and I mean, I think thinking about the question that we've been asking, where do we go from here? I think a serious reimagining of what does public safety look like is critical. And in conversations that I've had recently, like the desire for there to be some kind of, you know, nonviolent person that I could call, like I want to, you know, nobody is upset at the way the fire department is serving the city. You know, there's shout out to the unproblematic firefighters out there, but that's what serving the city looks like. That's what protecting people who are in medical distress or who are burning down an apartment building, like that's serving the people versus the police, which I was very interested to hear about, you know, the origins of the Portland Police Union. There is a more, I don't know, insular. And I think also our culture just highlights, you know, how, and we've spoken about this as well, how many cop shows are there, and that the cops are always the good guys. Even the people that they are sort of chasing down wrongly, well, they had to do it. They were cops, or they were acting suspicious. You know, it's like, why'd you run from the cops? There's this whole ethos that is pushed again and again by insert cop show here, that the cops are the good guys and that the people deserve to be harassed. You know, they deserve to be scrutinized because everybody might be a criminal walking. It's just a matter of finding the charge that sticks.
Mm. I've got more to say about that.
because you studied this too, didn't you?
Yeah. We have is the protagonist in these like procedurals, you know, the like the fictional programs, what we always have is a consistent through line is they can't get the evidence the real way. And every constitutional or human right, the civil rights of people protect the trope is that the civil rights of people, your civil rights protect bad people from the cops, from accountability, from legal liability for the harm they do.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cops always find some weird loophole or workaround,
or they just start
kicking down doors and cracking skulls. And then,
Sonia, we gotta
the
hour. So I appreciate all that you're saying. I want to say, everyone, thank you for listening to The Gap. The Chauvin trial is not the end of the episode of Law and Order where we all get to tie it up and go home because justice was served. We didn't get justice, we got accountability. Tammy, what's coming up next?
Coming up next at 9 o'clock is Arab Voices, a show covering a wide range of issues such in the Arab world and Arab history, culture, civilization, Arab American civil rights and liberty, as well as immigration issues and more. Stay tuned, 9 o'clock. For the rest of the hours, you can go to kbo.fm, check out the schedule. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Tammy. This is The Gap. Thank you, the brilliant Althea, the multi-talented Sonia Terrestrial Angel. Thank you all so much. Have a fantastic Friday and weekend. Take care of each other, please, and stay safe.
See you on the radio.
Bye.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland, no compromise in defense of the truth.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the